From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Cardinal Bernard Law's funeral was held in Rome today. Here's Cardinal Sean O'Malley speaking yesterday.
That failure had tragic consequences for many individuals, their families, loved ones, and the Archdiocese as a whole, and it continues to do so.
We'll hear from Sylvia Poggioli in Rome. Also today, a conversation with Yvonne Spicer, Framingham's new mayor-elect.
I try to keep an open mind about all that I'm doing, and to be in this place today, right now, what we're about to embark on is pretty amazing and exciting.
Plus, the origin story of the classic song, White Christmas.
This was the world that they were hoping someday to return to, so everyone sort of retreated to this mythic New England past that never really existed.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Sounds there from funeral services today in Rome, the funeral of Cardinal Bernard Law, the former head of the Boston Archdiocese at the peak of the clergy sex abuse crisis. Pope Francis performed the final Latin commendation during Law's funeral inside St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican. Well, yesterday afternoon, Boston Cardinal Sean O'Malley, who was not in attendance at today's funeral, spoke to reporters about Law.
Cardinal Law was the pastor of this archdiocese when the church failed to respond to this sexual abuse of children. That failure had tragic consequences for many individuals, their families, loved ones, and the archdiocese as a whole, and it continues to do so.
But O'Malley also called for forgiveness.
Forgiveness is what Christianity is about, and that doesn't make it easy. So I appeal to people, particularly Christmas is about healing relationships and forgiveness. A big part of healing is being able to come to grips with our own difficulty in forgiveness.
NPR senior European correspondent Sylvia Poggioli was at Law's funeral this afternoon, and she joins us now from Rome. Sylvia, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, first of all, tell us about the funeral today. What happened? And I understand, were there protests?
No, there were no protests. First of all, you have to understand that getting into St. Peter's Basilica is no mean feat. First of all, there are tremendously long lines for tourists, and then there's a security and there's a metal detector. So it's quite a process. And then the actual mass was at the very, very end, at the last altar, at the end of the nave of the basilica. And the reason also there were no protests is really in terms of here, certainly Italians or generally in Europe, Cardinal Law is really not that well known.
Uh-huh.
And so it wouldn't be likely that you would see protests in the square.
I see. So what role then did Pope Francis have in the funeral mass?
Very little. The mass itself was celebrated by the dean of the College of Cardinals, Angelo Soldano, together with 30 other cardinals. And that's quite a long ceremony. It's just about an hour. In his eulogy, Cardinal Soldano made no mention of the clerical sex abuse scandal involving Cardinal Law. And then, as is very much the custom in all funerals for cardinals that take place here in Rome, Pope Francis appeared only at the very end of the ceremony. He walked around the coffin, he blessed it with incense and holy water, and then he recited in Latin the ritual prayer commending the deceased to God. It was very brief, 4 or 5 minutes, and the ceremony was over.
I see. So everything then according to Catholic tradition then for the funeral of a cardinal.
Absolutely. And I could say that in general, since the announcement of Cardinal Law's death yesterday early yesterday morning in Rome, in by Vatican standards, both the ceremony today and the whole treatment, it's been really without any of the very little of the pomp and circumstance that are standard in these cases. Even Pope Francis's ritual telegram to the dean of to Cardinal Sodano was very low key. There was very few words. He didn't even mention that Law had been Archbishop of Boston. Compared to, for instance, the telegram he sent for the death of a cardinal last month, it was very bland. In that other one, he spoke great words of tributes to his esteem, gratitude, et cetera, et cetera. None of that was present. So by Vatican standards, this has been really low-key, really below the radar.
Huh, that's really interesting. But Sylvia, I'm wondering, I imagine that abuse survivors, especially those listening here in Boston, might see the Vatican not making any mention of this as essentially a sin of omission. I mean, a lot of people believe that progress has not been made, or significant progress hasn't been made by the Vatican in dealing with the clergy sex abuse crisis. And to that point, I just want to play a little clip from our show yesterday when we spoke with Walter Robinson, formerly of the Boston Globe Spotlight team. And he basically said that. He said the church has yet to reckon with this crisis.
I think many of us think of the church, even under Pope Francis, of trying to move slowly from the late 17th into the early 18th century. It is not true that the church has dealt in any responsible way with the abuse.
So, Sylvia, what do you make of that?
Well, as I said, you know, the fact that they didn't mention much else is also very significant. But you're right. I mean, however low key this was by Vatican standards, I mean, victims of clerical sex abuse in Boston, elsewhere in the United States, cannot but, you know, feel tremendous anger, frustration, and worse, that Cardinal Law was never made accountable by the church. And in fact, you know, since Pope Francis has been Pope, you know, there have been great expectations. He, early in his papacy, he promised to tackle the issue radically, but frankly, he has not delivered. Both a proposal to create a tribunal to put bishops who covered up abuse on trial was dropped. One of the closest aides, Cardinal Pell, the Australian, had to go home to defend himself against sexual abuse charges. Just last September, the Vatican called back a priest who was working in the Vatican Embassy in Washington after U.S. authorities wanted to charge him with possession of child pornography. The Vatican said he'd be investigated here, but so far no charges have been filed. And then probably most notably, the commission that Francis himself appointed 4 years ago to advise popes on how the church can protect children worldwide is languishing. The two members who were survivors of abuse resigned in frustration, and the remaining members' terms of office have expired with no official explanation of what happens next. So there's a sense here that there may be a movement inside the Vatican that feels, let's move on. The scandals have been dealt with. Some measures have been adopted. Payments of compensation and apologies have been made. So let's not talk about it anymore.
Right.
But that seems to be the prevailing feeling right here now.
And I should note that the commission that you mentioned, Boston's current Cardinal Sean O'Malley is the head of that commission. He did not travel to Rome, to the Vatican, for Cardinal Law's funeral. Absolutely fascinating. Well, NPR senior European correspondent Sylvia Poggioli speaking to us from Rome. Sylvia, a great pleasure. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
We usually do sports on Wednesday, but Bill Littlefield got bumped yesterday. And he's arrived here with us on Thursday very graciously. NPR's Only Game, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only Game, Bill Littlefield, is here. Hi, Bill.
Reminiscent of the days when I used to suffer hip checks. Bumped right out of the rink.
Exactly.
Once.
We play rough but fair here at Radio Boston. All right. So let's talk a little sports then, Bill. I want to start with this story about the fact that the Paw Sox, the Red Sox minor league team out of Pawtucket, is thinking about moving to Worcester. What do you make of that?
I think it would be too bad. I went to Paw Sox games a lot. Once my small daughters, when they were small anyway, gave me tickets to a Paw Sox game for Father's Day, and we all went down together, and it was great fun. I've enjoyed games there, and I think it would be very, very sad if Pawtucket were to lose the Paw Sox.
Yeah.
Also, Woo Sox just sounds awful.
It does. Now, if I get this right, part of the way they're going to decide is which city could give the team a better financial deal in their new stadium. I thought that was something that just was reserved for the majors.
Oh, no, no. That's something that even happens in spring training. Towns in Florida compete to give major league teams the better place to play for the, you know, very limited spring training season before the major league regular season begins. There is an economic benefit to it, and there's also a kind of cachet to being able to say, hey, you know, when you come down to Florida for a week in March, hey, you can see the Red Sox play or the Yankees or the Tigers, whoever it might be.
Okay, so obviously there's a benefit. Then that means if Pawtucket were to lose the Paw Sox, it'd be a loss for them.
Yeah, I don't know quite how people would measure that exactly. It's not like Florida. Nobody's okay. Flying to Pawtucket for a spring vacation.
Not yet, at least. All right. Well, so we'll see what happens there. But I kind of agree with you. No offense, Worcester, but Woo Sox doesn't quite have that same cachet.
You know, I think the one thing people might remember is, you know, no city needs a minor league baseball team as much as it needs, for example, a full complement in the fire department and a summer jobs program for teenagers. It's a nice thing to have, and the argument that it's a great economic engine has never been particularly convincing, but still, there's nostalgia involved, and it would be a shame.
Mm, okay. Well, let's move on to other sports news of this week, and I just really
I think
want
I know
you
what's
to
coming.
I just really want you to listen to this.
I'm not really sure of the claim. I mean, you're talking about my children. I don't think that's appropriate here. I'm trying to coach a football team. You know, there's a lot of pronouns there. Like, I don't really know who's talking about what. Sorry.
Okay.
The ever memorable Bill Belichick mumbling into the microphone.
Well, that is very best. We know you couldn't understand that. Mm. I know that. Mm. That was Bill Belichick saying, I'm not really sure what, I mean, you're talking about my children. I don't think that's appropriate here. I'm trying to coach a football team. Again, there's a lot of pronouns there. I don't really know who's talking about what. Hmm. Sorry.
Well, to his credit, he's doing a pretty good job of coaching a football team.
Yeah.
Just because he doesn't do a very good job of enunciating complete sentences in response to questions from reporters. That's okay. That's not his job.
Okay,
well,
so,
whoops, whoop. Yep, yes, it is.
So it is. So the question that the reporter asked was about Alex Guerrero,
yes.
Right? Who's
yes.
Tom Brady's body coach. And Belichick has recently banned Guerrero from team airplanes or the sidelines. And the reporter said basically, hey, what do you say? Tom's relationship with this trainer, it's like if your adult son or child is hanging out with somebody you didn't really care for all that much. And so that was Bill Belichick's answer. It was like, there's a lot of pronouns there.
Yeah,
I can't answer.
And don't talk about my family.
Now, Guerrero's the guy who he's partners with Brady and Tom Brady's TB12 business machine. He's the one who tells him to drink all that water.
Drink a lot of water and you won't get a sunburn and sleep in the sleep pod and pay $200 for the Tom Brady app. It's basically, it's a business partnership that depends on Tom Brady's celebrity and people thinking, gee, if I do all these things that Tom Brady does, I'll live forever just like him. And it's beans and bananas, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, you're get it. You're mumbling into Bill Belichick territory
Bill
here.
Asked me these okay, questions. But I don't know the answers.
Actual serious football question here, Bill. Is Belichick saying, okay, fine, like Tom Brady, you can do whatever you want, but Guerrero, maybe he shouldn't be messing with the other players on the Patriots.
I think he probably feels as if the stories that have come up recently about Guerrero, and they've come up in only a game, among other places, have been a distraction from what Belichick is trying to do, which is get everybody's mind on football so they play as well as they possibly can each week. And if reporters are coming in and saying, you know, what about this green substance that Tom Brady drinks or the fact that he has avocado ice cream or whatever the heck else, it's a distraction. And,
yeah.
And Belichick doesn't need it and he doesn't tolerate distractions.
Okay, we have just about 15 seconds, Bill. I want to give you a chance to give a hat tip to UConn.
Yeah, Gino Auriemma became the fourth or third or fourth, depending on whether Sylvia Hatchell won before or after he did. Anyway, coach of a women's college basketball team to win 1,000 games. There are four of them, and there's one man who coaches men's basketball and has won 1,000 games. And I don't have a t-shirt, but if you want to call in and try and guess who that is, I'm sure they'll accept your call.
Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, airs on WBUR on Saturdays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Thanks as always, Bill.
Wasn't that fun? Thank you, Meghna.
We'll be back. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On January 1st, Yvonne Spicer becomes a woman of many firsts. First mayor of Framingham, first popularly elected African-American female mayor in all of Massachusetts. Yvonne Spicer likes to build things. She's got a scientist's inquisitiveness and an entrepreneur's boundless energy. That combination took her from a hardscrabble childhood in Brooklyn to a doctoral degree in education to leading a startup division in educational advocacy at the Museum of Science. Now, of course, she's been elected into leading the biggest startup project of her life so far, converting Framingham from Massachusetts' once largest town to a fully functioning city government. It won't be easy. Framingham residents only narrowly approved a new city charter back in April. The margin was just 112 votes. And as mayor, Spicer has to bring those disparate factions together and oversee the mechanics of creating a municipal government. But based on the conversation I had with her earlier today, it seems that she's more than ready to take on the challenge. We went to Framingham to talk with Mayor-elect Spicer to hear about her vision for the city. But first, we started by hearing the remarkable story of where she got all that drive. Mayor-elect Yvonne Spicer, it is such a pleasure to meet you, and thank you for speaking with me today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I like to get to know people as well as possible, and one of my favorite things to do is to ask about their family. So can we start there?
Sure.
Tell me about growing up, and tell me about your parents.
Well, growing up, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. I am the eldest female child. I have two older brothers, and I was raised to believe that I could do anything. There were no limits.
How did they get that message to you?
You know, I was always very curious how things worked, and I remember when I was about 7 years old, I took the blender apart. I took the screwdriver and took it apart because I was curious how it worked, how what was in there causing the blades to go around, and I just wanted to see how it functioned. And I remember my father looking at me and, you know, and just smiling. You know, I certainly couldn't put it back together, but I was encouraged to pursue technical things.
But your father passed away when you were 10, right?
When I was 10, yes. My father died when I was 10. And in those short years, he taught me an awful lot. First of all, he loved my mother dearly, and I observed that. And, you know, whether a Friday night they would put on records and dance around the living room. And when he was probably pretty sick at this point, and I certainly didn't realize that he was home with us most of the time. But he taught me how to cook, and, you know, he would pull the chair up to the stove, and, you know, by the time I was about 10 years old, I could cook a full meal.
So he was sick for a while, but you didn't know it?
Yeah, my father was in and out of the hospital. He was a diabetic, and that's what he ultimately died from. He had a massive heart attack, but complications from diabetes. And from that point, I mean, here's my mother, you know, three small children, a 5-year-old, a 10-year-old, and a 13-year-old, and she went into overdrive and working three jobs at some points, you know, just being that beacon of light for me. And I'm truly a remarkable woman. Truly a remarkable.
Dorothy. Mm-hmm. That's her name.
Yeah. Okay. Dorothy Spicer was pretty amazing.
Tell me more about her, because she was working hard jobs too, right? I mean, not office jobs.
Right. My mother cleaned houses. At one point in her professional career, she worked in the jewelry factories in Manhattan. And so, you know, as my father was sick, she needed to be closer to home and have a little more flexibility in the schedule. So she cleaned houses. She, you know, worked office jobs, late night, mostly cleaning type jobs. Growing up, and even as a 12, 13-year-old, I would go and clean houses with her in the summertime.
Okay, so that gave you time to spend time with her, because I imagine, obviously, she was hugely busy. But you must have seen how, like, the other half or the other 1% lives. I don't know what kind of houses you were in.
We were in sky, like, beautiful penthouse apartments in Manhattan and on the Upper East Side, with doormen. And I remember asking my mother, how do we ever get to live in a place like this? And she said, baby, just get an education. Just get an education and you will one day. And I sometimes think about her always admonishing me to whatever job I did, do your very best. Never sidestep something. You know, always put your best effort forth. And so one of the most amazing things, she worked for this family and their daughter went to charm school. Yvonne Spicer went to charter school as a result of my mother's, well, if it's good enough for their daughter. And she worked an extra job to, you know, afford a little extra money to pay for me to go to charm school.
Wow. What an amazing woman.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that is so impressive about my mother later on in life, neither one of my parents ever saw the doors of a high school, let alone college. But later in life, my mother was probably in her late 60s. At that time, she went and studied for her GED.
No kidding.
I was so impressed with her. And you know, and the thing about it is, she says, well, I always enjoyed learning things. I just, you know, as a result of family life and needing to work and to have four college-educated children, all four of us have been to college, and it's pretty remarkable.
So I'm not sure, quite sure how to ask this, but I'll just ask you straight on. She was working all these jobs, raising her children, and doing this despite the considerable challenges that society puts in front of Black women.
Yes.
I mean, did she ever talk to you about, you know, like, about, like, you're a young Black woman, you're also going to have to overcome, like, the structural stuff that America puts in front of you?
You know, I think we were taught very early on, first of all, you love people for who they are. All people. And I never had limitations around people that I could spend time with or learn something from. But she also told me, you know, she said, you can't just be good. You got to be better than good. And at the time, I kind of understood what it meant. And that's why she just said, always do your very best. Always. Yeah. And that's something, you know, I certainly worked hard at it, doing my very best at everything, whether it was being a good student. I went to Catholic school for middle school, which, once again, my mother heard it was a better education and worked another job to pay for me to go to Catholic school.
Maybe I'm projecting here, but I feel like growing up, seeing your mother work so hard, and having vision, right, and matching effort to that vision. Like, you know, like, that school is going to be better for my kids. I'm going to work an extra job to send my kids to that school.
Yeah.
Maybe you didn't have to tell yourself this consciously, but did you say to yourself, I've got to do something with all that she's giving me?
Yeah. Well, oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I just sometimes think, you know, I used to sit and ponder, and after she passed away, and it would be, what would Dottie do? What would her wisdom be to me on them? And thinking about the ways in which you engage, and you say, are you being your best self?
Yeah.
Are you being your best self if you do that?
Wow.
And these are snippets that I've lived my life by, and they've been so valuable. You know, and I think I reflect back when I took my very first job, and when I came here to.
Yeah, because we have her to thank to bring that it was she launched you to go to Framingham, right?
Well,
or
it,
encouraged you.
Well, what she had encouraged me to do was, you know, I had my job interview, and I remember not. I love the person that was interviewing. I felt very good about him.
This is for a teaching job,
mm-hmm.
right?
But the teaching job was a subject matter that was not necessarily my strongest suit, and at a grade level that was not necessarily my strongest suit.
But we should say what it is, right? It was woodworking.
Woodworking. I was teaching woodworking at the middle school level. And I was much stronger in high school and also teaching architecture and engineering, drawing. And I asked my mother about this, and she said, well, if that woodworking is your Achilles heel, get in there and master it. So most people go to their first job doing what they're best at. I went to a job that was my weakness more so than a strength. But as a result, I learned very early on never to shy away from something that is challenging, that you may not know all the answers, but certainly get in there and do your very best. Yeah. And I've done that throughout my whole professional career, and it's expanded my repertoire of things that I can do.
You got to wonder, though, why they didn't offer you a high school architecture teaching job, though.
Certainly at that time, they didn't have one. I eventually did go to the high school and teach in architecture and engineering. But I was the first woman ever hired in Framingham to teach tech ed.
Wow. Remind me what year this was.
1985.
85. Okay.
1985.
we're going to be talking about a lot of firsts with you, Mayor-elect. But just so that folks know, you have a doctorate in education, and obviously you did tremendous work at the Museum of Science as well. So, but before we wrap up sort of talking about your fabulous family, when did your mother pass away?
She died a week after 9/11. And I remember it very distinctly because she was in the hospital and she was ill, and I was going to New York every weekend to just spend time with her, and because I was here working, work all week and drive home to New York. And it was when 9/11 happened, I had just left New York. I see what's happening on television, and I try to call New York and I couldn't reach anyone. So I panicked. Just for days, for two or three days, I could not reach anyone. And so I got in my car and just drove to New York because my whole family lives there. My mother was, you know, still in the hospital, and she passed away a week later. So, you know, and I think about it. We had a little chat before, and she said, you know, I remember her saying to me, "I'm just tired. I'm tired. I've given you everything. You'll be fine." So it's the kind of thing where she's always here. Yeah. And she is so proud of me right now. Both of my parents are. And my brothers, my sister, they'll all be here for the inauguration. So the good part is her legacy lives within me. So, and I truly am a blessed woman, because I've had incredible experiences. You know, I've gotten to a place in life where I don't even put limits. When someone says, what next? I said, well, I'm open and receptive. And I always feel that there's more that I can do, more that I can learn, more that I can experience in life. So I try to keep an open mind about all that I'm doing. And to be in this place today, right now, what we're about to embark on is pretty amazing and exciting.
I'm so profoundly moved and thankful for your parents and all they gave you and all they instilled in you, because Framingham needs it now. The soon-to-be city needs your drive.
Yeah.
And so let's talk about the new opportunities and challenges ahead that you're embracing and facing as Framingham's first mayor. Let's just be honest. It's still kind of a divisive issue whether or not Framingham should be a city. So after you get inaugurated, what are you going to do about that? Because I guess what I'm trying to say is how much of that is going to influence how you approach the job?
You know, part of me getting into the race was that we get to choose the kind of city we want to be. You know, I wasn't polarized on either side of the issue. I felt that there are some things that we could certainly benefit from being a city, and there are so many things about our character that were cultivated as us being a town, so that I want to make sure we bring along with us. I have purposely made sure that I include the voices of even people that were opposing me in this election, because I think that's how we heal as a community, is to make sure that everyone's voices included.
Right, because that's one of the major, major differences I think people feel between a city structure and a town structure, right? Because the history of the Massachusetts town is all about citizen engagement, right? Direct citizen engagement and citizen decision making. So I mean, maybe it's too early to ask because you're not that far down the path, but like, how are you going to help preserve that, which is still important to so many people here?
Well, you know, as a part of our charter, there are boards and commissions that, you know, I do get to appoint citizens to, and I'm going to be very reflective of our community, making sure that all of our boards are as diverse as possible and getting varying perspectives. But I also look at those opportunities to engage with the community. community and having those community conversations and getting out with the public and having town hall type meetings where they can ask questions. They can, you know, tell me about the issues that are going on in their neighborhoods. Direction I'm moving is hiring a person that is a director of neighborhood services that works right in the community and getting a pulse on what's happening in the community, as well as working very closely with the council members who represent 9 different districts within the city. Because I think when people have a link to the mayor's office, they feel connected. And I think that's the part of the engagement piece that we don't want to lose.
You know, this is such an amazing opportunity for Framingham, right? Because this basically never happens in Massachusetts, right? You get to build a city governance structure from scratch. It's like the opposite of what most Massachusetts cities have to deal with. They got to deal with sort of the baggage of history that comes along with it. So, I mean, what are the kinds, one or two of the kinds of things that you think you do? You mentioned neighborhood services, but are a kind of a priority for you?
One of the key priorities is economic development in the community. If we can build the capacity for businesses to locate here in Framingham, such as high-tech kinds of jobs, where people can actually live and work in Framingham, we are ahead of the curve, and so to speak. And I also am particularly focusing on the downtown area of Framingham. If we could anchor some of these businesses in downtown, people can live in the downtown, work in the downtown, and then also it helps drive some of the development in downtown. You know, my hope and my vision is having our downtown be a destination on a Friday night, similar to some other communities where people will say, "Where are you going Friday? We're going downtown Framingham," you know. And that's what I'm hoping for, is to rebuild, particularly in the downtown.
Yeah. You know, there are lots of different models of leadership for city mayors, right? There's the sort of, you know, like I'm the big picture visionary mayor. Then there's the opposite end of the spectrum of, you know, the sort of nitty-gritty, I'm going to fix all your potholes, municipal services mayor. I mean, where do you think you might fall on that spectrum?
I think I kind of fall in the middle. You know, in some ways, I certainly am a visionary, and the fact that I work in a startup division of the museum for the last 12 years that didn't exist, and it has grown, and through the vision and implementing the vision, it has grown over the last 12 years, and I'm pretty proud of the work we've done, the team of us have done at the museum, and I'm looking forward to bringing some of that vision to Framingham, but also looking at, yes, the day-to-day has to get done, the trash has to be picked up, and that happens in Framingham. Snow removed, the potholes fixed. Those are some definite important things to the community. So it's not reinventing the wheel, but it's also saying, how do we access some good best practices? And that has already started to happen for me. Talking with other mayors from across the country, I have had a chance to reach out and actually meet a number of new mayors, newly elected mayors.
Who have you met?
I actually, a few weeks ago, met Vi Lyles, and she's in North Carolina, in Charlotte. And I also met the new mayor of New Orleans.
Wow.
And it was about 25 of us. We did a training of new mayors, but also with some veteran mayors. So all told, about 75 people or so. But that's the beauty, is that no matter what you're facing, there's another mayor that has faced it as well. So I certainly built my little network of people that I could reach out to for a number of different issues.
What's some of the best advice you received from those veteran mayors?
Oh, the best advice was, have fun with this job and enjoy it, and remember that you can't solve all of the challenges immediately. So, be gentle with yourself, and listen, do a lot more listening, so that was a general consensus about that.
So just a couple more questions, because you are a very busy woman. I should have asked this a lot earlier, and I'm sorry that I didn't, and forgive me for being, maybe this is, might just be a kind of silly question, but you had a really great thing going at the Museum of Science, and I'm just wondering what made you think, I'm going to run for mayor for Framingham.
You're absolutely right. I certainly love my work at the museum. And once again, it goes back to the lesson I learned from Dorothy Spicer. Get in there. I've mastered my job at the Museum of Science. I mean, it started from a vision, and I felt like I was leaving the museum in a very good place. And I saw this as an opportunity to bring my experience to something brand new and lay the foundation to set this city on the right course. And it seemed very exciting to me, and it's certainly not foreign to me to start something new and work in a direction that is providing good leadership, vision, and a strategic plan to implement.
You know, I just want to note explicitly that Framingham has beat Boston on a very, very important measure, and that is having elected a person of color into the mayor's office. So well done, Framingham. But you're also believed to be the first popularly elected African-American female mayor in Massachusetts. And so I guess that brings us back to Dorothy. Because I think I'm thinking about what she told you about, you know, that you're going to not only have to be good, you're going to have to be better than good. Are you concerned that also applies to this job, that people are looking at you as a black woman in this major leadership position? And not that they don't think you can't do it, not that, but that the expectation of you is going to be higher than it might have been if a white man had won the race.
I have been the first in a lot of situations. And in this election, where nearly 59% of the people voted me into this office, and Framingham is a 70% majority. And so most of
majority
my
minority?
Majority white.
Majority white. Majority,
yes,
white.
Majority,
yeah, yeah.
White. And I think much of the effort in this community to elect me to this office was more about my experience and my vision, and less to do with my ethnicity. Now, not that that is not going to be a factor, and, you know, it certainly it is always something that I'm consciously aware of, but I don't let it limit me or change the course of my actions.
Yeah. I mean, I don't mean to make everything about race, but also this is America in 2017,
yes,
and we can't not talk about it as well.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. And it is, you know, yes, for some people it will be a factor. But I think for the most part of what people in this community wanted and needed to hear, first of all, that we have a government that people can participate in, it's transparent, and that I came with no baggage. I wasn't beholden to any special interest groups. I'm new to politics, so I don't owe anybody any favors. And so that's the kind of thing that resonated with people's spirit. And the fact that they kind of looked and said, yeah, well, this lady is kind of smart, and she's, you know, she has had a proven track record. And I just felt that they felt confident in me.
And folks should know that you go boxing in the morning. I just wanted people to know that.
I do indeed. And I really enjoy, you know, taking boxing class. And, you know, not only is it a stress reliever, but you just feel very empowered.
Yeah. Well, Framingham Mayor-elect Yvonne Spicer, it has been such a pleasure to speak with you. Congratulations. And promise me that we can come back in 6 months so we can talk a little bit more about the nitty-gritty of getting Framingham launched as a city.
Absolutely, absolutely. And thank you for having me today.
We spoke with Mayor-elect Spicer in Framingham earlier today. Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, of course, those are the dulcet tones of Bing Crosby in his original 1942 recording of White Christmas, written by Irving Berlin. It is the kind of piece that immediately inspires a holiday mood.
And children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow.
But White Christmas also has quite a story behind it, one that maybe you haven't heard.
Dreaming of a white Christmas.
Joining us now is conductor, composer, commentator, and author Rob Capello. Rob, it is great to have you back.
It's great to be back.
Okay, so this is one of my favorite Christmas songs.
Me too.
Tell us, what is it that you love about it?
Well, you know, I mean, first I love that this is actually written by an immigrant Jew.
Yeah.
That somehow this perfect quintessential Christmas song was written by an immigrant Jew inventing the soundtrack of Christmas for America. I mean, it's a fantastic story. Also, what I love is that there is actually a verse to this that no one knows. Originally, this song was written as a parody. The original
really?
Beginning of this song was, "The sun is shining, the grass is green, the orange and palm trees sway. There's never been such a day in Beverly Hills, L.A.
Beverly Hills.
Hills, L.A. And it was set in the present tense, and then it was about going back to this distant past. Once it became clear that this was this wonderful postcard of a New England distant past that everyone wished was theirs, they got rid of the verse. But originally, it was supposed to be a parody song with a completely different verse.
Oh, that's so interesting, because, yeah. I mean, instead, the version that Irving Berlin gave the world, I mean, it is like the definitive song of secular Christmas song.
It is the definitive song. Although it's interesting, it's the definitive song, but it really says only two things about Christmas.
Yeah.
I mean, all it gives you is that there's treetops glistening and children listening to sleigh bells. The rest is perfect for you to project on this almost blank slate.
And people do.
And they do. I mean, the other thing that's so wonderful about this song is that it became a hit really around Christmas time in 1942, which was the time when our boys, GIs, were spending their first Christmas away. And so in a way, it became the kind of thing that they thought they were fighting for. This was the world that they were hoping someday to return to. So everyone sort of retreated to this mythic New England past that never really existed. And it sort of caught the hearts of those at home yearning for the boys overseas at Christmas 1942 and vice versa.
So let's talk about how the music captures
it. It's fantastic. Now, every detail is perfect. First of all, it starts with the very first chord. Anyone would have started with a simple chord like this. I'm. But he adds one note which gives all the warmth of Christmas. And listen closely. Not this, but this.
Yeah.
So we have this wonderful foggy window. Now, the normal version would go like this. For dreaming of a. But listen to his fantastic chords. Dreaming. Listen to this one. I mean, that chord is spectacular. Ordinary. Berlin.
Yeah.
That chord. Then, White Christmas. The normal version would be Christmas. But listen to his great chords. I mean, you can feel that yearning in just those two chords. Now then, every detail is perfect.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know.
We started off with a long note and fast notes. Long note, I'm, fast notes. Dreaming of a. Long note, fast notes. White, fast notes. Christmas. Anyone else would have continued with another long note. Just like the ones I know.
Yeah.
But listen to how it rises up the scale with yearning. Just like the ones.
Hmm.
And then back to the past. The ones I used to know. Now, treetops glisten. The normal way would have been this. Where the treetops glisten. That's perfectly fine. That's what I call my Salieri version of Irving Berlin.
Poor Salieri.
I know. There's someone out there from the Salieri state who's going to call in. I know. But glisten, get normal in your ear. Tops glisten. But listen to how he makes the treetops glisten. Tree, right here. Tops. Now listen. I mean, that's what makes it tug at your hearts. And then the same thing. Children listen could easily be this. And children listen.
Yeah.
But he does this beautiful left hand. Children. Now listen to this one minor chord.
Mm.
You know, it's interesting. He had a child die on Christmas. So Irving Berlin always had a complex emotional reaction to Christmas. It was always a memory of that really sad day. And it's all right there in that one chord. Listen, to hear sleigh bells. Now watch this. This is in the original version. In the snow, he actually writes the sleigh bells into the piano part. These are the sleigh bells. Now, the ending is what makes it spectacular. We repeat the whole thing just as if we were copying for the next verse. I'm dreaming of a what? Exactly the same Christmas with every Christmas card I write. Exact same copy. Yeah. He could have easily finished with a copy like this. May your days be merry and bright.
Yes.
But instead of going down on the word bright, get that in your ear, merry and bright. He goes an octave higher. Days be merry and bright. I mean, that note and that chord. And then this minor color. I mean, that is what makes it great. That high bright, which is bright, but then maybe not. Mm. And then the ending. And may all your Christmases, Mrs. Now, why does this sound so perfect and final? Now, if this is your home chord, this is the same note in the melody. That's what makes resolution. But you could have three different notes in the chord. You could have this or this. The one that's final is this.
Yeah.
Every other chord in the piece that has had this has had either this or this in the melody. We've had I'm up here. We've had no. We've had treetops. We've had I'm. We've had right. We've had days. Only on the very last note of the piece do we have Christmases be bright. Save to make the last chord fine. Finally, the boys are home. We're back in the home key. We have the melody note and the chord the same. And all is resolved. We've traveled back to a distant past that never was, but the one that we all wished we had.
Wow. Well, we have the Bing Crosby singing version.
Ready for the leap. Oh.
And may all your Christmases.
The only resolution.
Be
come on, if you don't feel like you've got snowflakes on your eyelashes after hearing that, you have no soul. You know what I'm always amazed by this music is it's so beautiful, so complex, but it's very efficiently done, right? Because these are not long songs.
You know, that's the thing. You know, I mean, a great Broadway song usually has to tell a full story in 32 measures. And not only that, but often 24 of those 32 measures are the same music. The most common form is AABA. So you hear an idea, you hear the same idea again, you go away for a minute to something else, and you come back again. So not only do you have to tell a story in an efficient terms, but you really have to have one 8-bar idea that has the essence of it. And that 8-bar idea that we took apart, that is the essence of a complex outsider's view of Christmas.
So tell me more about that, right? Because I want to explore that more with you, because I don't imagine that Irving Berlin is, well, we know he wasn't someone who grew up celebrating Christmas.
No.
Well, so how did he, I mean, he had this capacity to capture its essence in a song.
Yeah, you know, I think oftentimes what we don't realize is it's outsiders who see us sometimes better than ourselves. Almost all of the major secular Christmas songs were written by Jews. You know, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, Winter Wonderland, Let It Snow, Let It Snow, Let It Snow. I mean, all of these were written by Jews who are actually anxious to assimilate. And, you know, the first thing they did to assimilate was they all changed their names. Mm-hmm. So they would, I mean, Israel Bailin became, you know, Irving Berlin. You know, Hyman Arluck became Harold Arlen. You know, they all changed their name. And it was this desire to belong, to be part of the American dream, to be part of the American story. And a lot of that yearning that you feel in this music is a yearning for a childhood they never had, for a country that they didn't actually belong to, but they then felt an incredibly poignant yearning towards it. So I think that that's what gives it that kind of extra special sense of yearning. It's people trying to belong to something that they never actually were a part of and literally inventing Christmas out of their own imaginations.
Yeah. And in return, they gave us all the gift of something great. Music, timeless music for us
all.
And
in fact, allowed us all to assimilate because it suddenly became a holiday for all of us. You know, I've been in Malaysia and you hear White Christmas played at the Starbucks in Malaysia. So literally it has become the soundtrack for the world's Christmas. So that's a great immigrant outsiders creating the soundtrack to the American dream that then becomes the world's Christmas.
Well, Rob Capello is conductor, composer, commentator, and author extraordinaire. He joins us on occasion to break down what makes a musical piece great. And today he walked us through the genius of White Christmas by Irving Berlin. Rob, it's always so great to have you. Thank you so much.
A pleasure to be here.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.